MyAudiobooks.ai presents Russia's Closed Cities, Life Inside the Soviet Nuclear Archipelago. On September 29, 1957, a cooling failure inside an underground waste tank triggered a massive chemical explosion at the Myok nuclear complex in the southern Ural Mountains. The blast ejected a radioactive cloud high into the atmosphere, scattering dangerous fallout across thousands of square kilometers of surrounding forests, rivers, and farming villages. For decades, official Soviet atlases showed only unbroken wilderness across the contaminated zone.
Beside that facility stood a bustling municipality of tens of thousands of residents. The town contained tree-lined boulevards, schools, hospitals, cultural palaces, and residential apartment blocks. Yet on paper, this community did not exist. It had no public name, appeared on no civilian map, and was sealed behind concentric rings of barbed wire and armed guard posts. How does a government make an entire city vanish from public geography? What did daily life look like inside an artificial blank space? And why does this concealed urban network endure long after the empire that constructed it disappeared?
At myaudiobooks.ai, you can create your own audiobooks from prompts, turn your documents into audio, all with one subscription, and store your items in your own personal library. The origins of this hidden archipelago lie in the opening years of the Cold War. In August 1945, the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki transformed global military strategy overnight. In response, Soviet leadership launched an intensive program to develop their own nuclear deterrent.
Between 1946 and 1950, planners laid the foundations for a network of secret industrial centers. A second wave followed throughout the 1950s. Building an atomic arsenal required specialized industrial installations. The state needed dedicated hubs to enrich uranium, synthesize plutonium, and assemble thermonuclear weapons. In 1946, planners established a secret weapons design laboratory on the grounds of a former monastery near Sarov, roughly 400 kilometers east of Moscow. Known as Arzamas 16, this enclave gathered the country's premier physicists and mathematicians. Their work culminated in the first successful Soviet atomic detonation in August 1949.
To protect these sensitive installations from foreign intelligence and public awareness, authorities replaced real geographic names with coded postal identities. Each settlement adopted the name of a nearby regional capital, followed by a designated number. The complex adjacent to Myak became Chelyabinsk 40, later altered to Chelyabinsk 65. The Siberian Enrichment Center near the Tom River became Tomsk 7. The underground plutonium combine along the Yenisei River was named Krasnoyarsk 26.
Concealment functioned across three distinct levels. First, the state omitted these towns from published maps, road atlases, and passenger rail timetables. Second, officials routed communications through substitute postal boxes, hiding the physical locations of thousands of citizens. Third, when a settlement was too large to erase completely, authorities concealed its true industrial function, describing nuclear weapons plants as ordinary industrial factories.
In modern Russian law, these jurisdictions are designated as closed administrative territorial formations, commonly known by the acronym ZATO. That legal category was established in the post-Soviet era. During the Soviet period, these settlements operated under classified ministerial decrees, where preserving state secrecy meant controlling every detail of municipal existence. Maintaining cartographic invisibility required converting security protocols into the fabric of daily civic routine. The physical perimeter was the first line of defense. High concrete walls, multi-layered barbed wire, electronic perimeter sensors, and elevated guard towers encircled each community. Access was restricted to fortified checkpoints manned by internal security forces.
Crossing these gates required specialized documentation that went far beyond ordinary internal passports. Residence permits were tied directly to employment at the primary strategic enterprise or immediate family relations. Non-resident relatives had to submit entry applications months in advance to undergo exhaustive background investigations. Spontaneous visits from outside the perimeter were impossible. Anyone arriving without pre-approved security clearance was turned away at the gates.
State surveillance extended into personal communication. Inhabitants signed strict non-disclosure agreements, subjecting them to severe criminal prosecution for revealing their workplace, mentioning their location, or discussing local industrial operations. Personal correspondence was routed through centralized postal sorting hubs, where state censors monitored letters and redacted sensitive text before delivery. Personal freedom of movement was strictly asymmetric. While outsiders could not enter, residents faced significant obstacles when attempting to leave. Senior physicists, design engineers, and technical specialists were prohibited from traveling abroad. Even domestic journeys required official travel orders, ensuring authorities could track strategic personnel at all times.
Civic administration was subordinated to the dominant employer, known as the city-forming enterprise. In Sarov, the Experimental Physics Institute guided urban development. In Ozersk, the Mayak Combine operated the heating grid, maintained apartment complexes, and funded regional medical facilities. The municipal government reported directly to atomic energy ministries in Moscow, bypassing regional authorities and aligning local life with national defense targets. The Soviet nuclear complex was anchored by 10 major closed cities, divided into two essential functions: weapons design and materials production. Five locations formed the backbone of this defense infrastructure.
Sarov, formerly Arzamas 16, served as the primary design hub. It was the birthplace of both the Soviet atomic and thermonuclear bombs. The city maintained experimental laboratories, high explosive testing facilities, and computational centers dedicated to warhead development. To prevent scientific stagnation and encourage competing designs, authorities founded a second design hub in 1955 at Snezhensk, designated Chelyabinsk 70. Situated in the Ural Mountains, Snezhensk focused on warhead miniaturization and ballistic missile systems for the naval submarine fleet.
The production sector provided the fissile materials necessary for these designs. Ozersk, initially known as Chelyabinsk 40, was established around the Mayak Combine to manufacture weapons-grade plutonium. It later expanded its operations into spent fuel reprocessing and specialized radioisotope extraction. Further east in Siberia, Zhelezhnogorsk, coded as Krasnoyarsk 26, was founded around 1950 along the Yenisei River.
To protect plutonium reactors from potential airstrikes, engineers excavated massive, cavernous halls deep inside a granite mountain. They constructed an entire industrial production facility beneath hundreds of meters of rock, later expanding into the manufacture of communication satellites. Downstream in western Siberia, Seversk, known as Tomsk 7, was established in 1949. Operating the Siberian Chemical Combine, it handled industrial-scale uranium enrichment and chemical separation, growing into the largest closed city with a population approaching 100,000.
Operating under unrelenting production pressures, these facilities produced severe environmental impacts. The 1957 Kishtim disaster at Mayak contaminated thousands of square kilometers. Because the site was officially secret, the state evacuated more than 20 surrounding villages without explaining the underlying cause to the public. For years, liquid radioactive waste was discharged directly into the Techa River network, producing chronic contamination across downstream communities. While the physical dispersion of isotopes is documented in historical records, the full long-term health consequences remain subject to scientific debate due to decades of classified medical registries.
For the citizens living inside the perimeter,
Everyday existence was defined by an unwritten social contract. The state compensated for physical confinement, isolation, and constant surveillance by providing living conditions superior to those in open Soviet municipalities.
Workers received substantial wage premiums, frequently 30 to 40% above national averages, alongside preferential retirement packages. Housing consisted of modern, well-maintained apartment complexes with short waiting lists and reliable central heating. While ordinary Soviet cities faced chronic consumer shortages, closed city grocery stores were consistently stocked with fresh meats, dairy products, imported fruit, and consumer apparel. Well-equipped schools, specialized medical centers, and cultural palaces created an insulated and prosperous living environment. Scientific and technical personnel derived profound prestige from their assignments. Contributing directly to the National Nuclear Shield instilled a strong sense of patriotic purpose and collective pride. Yet these benefits came with clear trade-offs. Daily life involved monitored telephone lines, restricted personal travel, and limited professional options for family members who lacked security clearances. Living adjacent to nuclear reactors and chemical separation plants also exposed workers and their families to ongoing industrial hazards.
Accounts from residents reveal contrasting memories of this arrangement. Many remember safe, quiet neighborhoods where violent crime was virtually unknown and children walked freely at night. Others recall claustrophobic isolation, institutional paranoia, and the frustration of being unable to invite close relatives into their homes. Both viewpoints reflect the fundamental reality of the closed city. Security and privilege were inextricably linked to state control. When the Soviet Union dissolved in December 1991, many observers expected the security perimeters would fall and the secret cities would merge into ordinary regional geography. Instead, the Russian government formalized their unique status.
On July 14, 1992, the Russian Federation passed Law No. 3297-1, establishing the legal foundation for closed administrative territorial formations. Rather than abolishing the enclaves, the statute established rules for municipal governance, security perimeters, and specialized federal financial subsidies. During the 1990s, historical secrecy yielded to partial openness. Numeric postal codes were replaced by official city names. Chelyabinsk 65 became Ozersk, Tomsk 7 became Seversk, and Arzamas 16 returned to its historic name of Sarov. Their locations appeared on civilian maps, and news agencies reported on their affairs.
However, public recognition did not mean unrestricted access. Perimeter fences, electronic sensors, and military checkpoints remained fully operational. Non-resident citizens still require background checks and entry permits, while visits by foreign nationals remain strictly controlled. Economic instability during the post-Soviet transition reinforced local support for closure. As federal spending plummeted in the 1990s, retail privileges eroded and wages were delayed. Yet residents viewed the physical fence as protection against the organized crime, economic turbulence, and social disruption affecting open municipalities.
Continuing strategic defense missions ensured institutional survival. Securing nuclear warheads, decommissioning retired reactors, processing spent fuel, and enriching commercial uranium required stringent physical protection. The State Atomic Energy Corporation, Rosatom, together with the Ministry of Defense and the space agency Roscosmos, maintained direct funding to safeguard these facilities. In the 2020s, roughly 40 to 42 closed formations remain officially recognized in Russia, home to an estimated 1.5 million people. Approximately 10 are core nuclear research and production centers, while the rest host naval bases, intercontinental missile silos, and aerospace testing grounds.
These communities now face complex economic questions. Broadening the local economy remains difficult because private businesses and outside capital face substantial security hurdles. Limited municipal tourism initiatives operate under tight official oversight, keeping access restrictions firmly in place.
environmental remediation around older production complexes requires open scientific cooperation, yet security regulations limit independent scrutiny.
For younger generations, mobility remains the central challenge. The closed city provides safety, dependable municipal services, and quiet streets. But professional advancement outside the primary state enterprise is narrow. Residents must ultimately decide whether to stay within the security of the perimeter or pursue broader opportunities in the open world.
The enduring presence of closed cities shows how deeply national security can reshape physical geography. A standard map presents an accessible world, suggesting every municipality is open to travel and inquiry. Yet these sealed communities demonstrate that cartography can be deliberately partitioned by state power. They leave us to consider what it means to build a life inside an intentional blank space, where the boundary between protection and isolation remains permanently drawn. Thanks for watching. To create your own audiobooks from your prompts and documents, visit myaudiobooks.ai. Subscribe for more.